Good evening, everyone. I'm Roxanne Duvall, the Secretary of the Board of Directors for the International Museum of Women. I'd like to welcome you to a very special speaker series with Aminata Forna. I'm looking at her to see if I pronounced it roughly right. We're pleased to present tonight's program in partnership with the World Affairs Council of Northern California, and I would like to extend a special welcome to their members here tonight. Since 1947, the World Affairs Council of Northern California has provided a forum where leaders of all sectors can join members of the public to engage in dialogue that deepens understanding and becomes the basis of informed action. To learn more about how to get involved with the Council and support their mission, please visit their website at www.itsyourworld.org. For those of you who are new to the International Museum of Women, I'd like to say a few words about the museum. As an innovative virtual museum, we exhibit women's art, multimedia, and ideas, and act as a creative catalyst for social change, propelling audiences to take action to fuel women's human rights worldwide. 600,000 people from 200 countries visited our online exhibitions last year at our website, www.imow.org. The International Museum of Women is a unique place where women worldwide can express themselves, inspire others, and imagine ways the world could be different. And I know that's exactly what you're going to experience tonight. But before, I'd like to extend special thank you to the staff, board, volunteers of the museum and the World Affairs Council, our community partners for tonight's program, Book Passage, CAMFED, the Global Fund for Women, Human Rights Watch, Priority African Network, Professional Business Women of California, and SPARC. And a very special thanks to Wells Fargo for sponsoring tonight's event. We are deeply grateful for their ongoing support and commitment. Here to say a few words from Wells Fargo is Chidam Genser, Head of Family Wealth Solutions, Wells Fargo.
Thank you. Thank you for welcoming me here tonight. Wells Fargo is so pleased to participate in bringing wonderful programs such as IMOW's Extraordinary Voices, Extraordinary Change Speaker Series to San Francisco. We are delighted to partner with an organization so committed to illustrating how women are and can make a difference in the world. Ralph Waldo Emerson once wrote that fiction reveals truth that reality obscures. We welcome Aminata Forna tonight in that spirit of revealing truth through her powerful work. Thank you for sharing your voice with us tonight. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Chidam. Before I introduce our speaker, I'm delighted to announce that tonight's program is being recorded for future podcasts and will be available on both the websites of the World Affairs Council and the International Museum of Women. I would also encourage you all to make use of the question cards, little blue cards that you found on your seats, to place any questions you might have for Aminata. You have volunteers at the back, Bethany, I think, that will be picking up these cards as you have questions and providing them to Claire. It would also be greatly appreciated, as I'm sure you expect, if you would turn off all your devices at this point and avoid disturbing the program to the extent possible. Now, without further ado, I'm thrilled to welcome tonight's guest, who has an extraordinary voice and extraordinary experiences to share with us, and who shares the museum's passion for telling untold stories. Aminata Forna has an impressive and diverse background as a journalist, humanitarian, and author of three highly acclaimed and award-winning books. The torturous events of Sierra Leone's history have dominated her writing. Forna's first book, a memoir, The Devil That Danced on the Water, movingly illuminates her own history. She is the daughter of a physician and former Sierra Leonean cabinet minister and dissident who was murdered by the state in 1975. Born in Scotland, she moved between Britain and her paternal homeland, Sierra Leone, where her activist father was arrested, imprisoned, and ultimately executed by the government when she was 11. In the memoir, Forna describes her childhood and returns as a journalist to investigate her father's political murder and speak to the people who had a hand in his death. The Devil That Danced on the Water was shortlisted for the Samuel Johnson Prize and became a national bestseller here in the United States. Her next book and first novel, Ancestor Stones, it's here tonight, available if anyone would like to buy it, is a sweeping portrayal of the lives of five Sierra Leonean women and the effects of Sierra Leone's civil war on the country's women. It was selected as a New York Times Editor's Choice and winner of the Hurston Wright Legacy Award for debut fiction. Now with her new novel, The Memory of Love, Forna cements herself as one of the contemporary Africa's most perceptive and important chroniclers. Set in post-colonial Sierra Leone a few years after the Civil War, The Memory of Love is a breathtaking view of modern Africa through the eyes of both insiders and outsiders who struggle to cope with the aftermath of a war waged against and amongst civilians. Her novel depicts a deeply hopeful and universal story about love and human resilience. As a journalist, she has produced and presented several television documentaries, most recently, The Lost Libraries of Timbuktu for the BBC, and her journalism has appeared in the Sunday Times, The Observer, Granta, and Vogue, amongst others. Aminata Forna divides her time between London and Sierra Leone, where she leads the Rubanko Project. In 2003, the Rubanko Village School opened its doors, and since then, the project has spread to include education, agriculture, infrastructure, and health in a community effort to create an escape route for poverty. Aminata is a trustee of the Royal Literary Fund and sits on the advisory committee of the Kane Prize for African Writing. We at the International Museum of Women are honored that she is a member of the museum's Global Council, an advisory group of 26 world leaders. We are truly honored that she is here with us tonight. This evening, Aminata Forna will be in conversation with Claire Winterton, the executive director of the International Museum of Women. Please join me in giving both Aminata Forna and Claire Winterton a warm welcome.
So Aminata, welcome. We're thrilled to have you here with us in San Francisco. And the catalyst for this evening is your incredible new novel. But before we talk about that, I wanted to step back a little bit and talk about the evolution of your career as a novelist. You started out as a journalist. Your early works were nonfiction. So what precipitated your move into fiction?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say thanks so much for having me here. It's great to be back in the Bay Area again. I started out as a journalist. Well, actually, I would have become a writer sooner if I'd had a private income, I think. I started out as a journalist, I think, to pay the rent. It was the closest thing to writing. Actually, it's extremely different. I studied law at university, and I quite quickly discovered that I didn't want to be a lawyer. And I joined the BBC after that and stayed there for 10 years. But actually, when I was at school, I remember saying to my careers mistress that I wanted to be a writer, and she said, well, that's very hard and it's going to be very difficult for you to make a living like that. So I said, well, I'd like to do it anyway. And I, at that time I was studying languages, and she said, well, what about becoming a translator, you know, instead? And this is sort of girls' education all over, isn't it? So she said, how about becoming a translator instead? So I said, oh. I said, well, I rather thought I'd write the books that were translated. And she said to me, I've never heard such arrogance in my life.
Wow.
I have to say, though, since this is going to be podcast, that I have seen her since, and she's incredibly proud of all that I've done, and we've all forgotten that particular
incident. That must have been a great moment.
But I've been back to my school to speak and encourage many girls to go into this this very unstable career path. But I would have become a writer earlier, you know, it's just that, life takes on different paths. And actually none of it really matters, because writing is one of those very few career options that benefit from experience. So better write better later, as it were.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel there are things that you can achieve through fiction that you couldn't achieve through journalism?
Yes, I do. Journalism had many frustrations for me. I mean, there were many things I loved about journalism. I loved being able to enter other people's lives. I loved the range and scope it gave me, the things that I discovered. But it's essentially a reductionist form, and I got very frustrated with having to put, being asked to put really quite complex ideas into not just simple, but actually simplistic terms. And you know, it didn't really have to be that way. We had scope to make longer programs. It's just that there was a sense in the mass media that people had incredibly short attention spans, and we were going to be led by that. I found it very frustrating, and I also got very frustrated with certain stories that I was covering. You know, particularly with Africa, there was only one story out of Africa, and it was the story of victimhood. And I got very frustrated with that. And I also could see that people really were literally switching off. You know, there was such a thing as empathy fatigue. We were creating it whilst telling ourselves that we weren't. And I really wanted to tell, in particular, African stories in a different way. I remember talking to one of my editors. I was a presenter, reporter, and documentary maker when I was there. And I talked to one of my editors about small place called Darfur that nobody had heard of at the time. And at one point he just said to me, listen, Aminata, just stop coming with these stories. Middle England is not interested in Africa. Now, he was not a stupid man, nor was he a particularly cruel man. He was trying to spare me from what he thought was a pointless activity. But I think that Middle England, Middle America, everywhere, you know, out of space, is interested in stories if they're told in the right way. So it was quite I got to the point where I just had to leave the BBC, really, and had to leave journalism and start to write these stories the way I thought they should be told.
Mm-hmm. And when you think about yourself as a storyteller, I think one of the things that you've said about yourself is that you feel that you're situated at a crossroads between race and cultures. You have parentage that's from Scotland and from Sierra Leone. And that puts you in a position where you're not part of the herd. You always have to be sort of outside the herd group. How does that inform who you are as a fiction writer?
It's always a tough one because I've never been anything else. Mm-hmm. I don't know what everybody else is thinking and feeling about what they are as fiction writers. But I guess I have grown up very used to interpreting cultures, interpreting one group for another. And what I have learned from that is that people are far more alike than they are unalike. When they appear to be unalike, there are usually quite simple explanations. If we can just get over, you know, the assumption of difference, difference is actually quite easily explained. Different situations give rise to different patterns of thinking. But people are not that unalike. I always remember being asked this question once, and I had just read something from The Devil That Danced on the Water about my grandfather, and there are two sections in that book about each of my grandfathers, my Scottish one and my Sierra Leonean one. And these men, to me, were absolutely identical. You know, they were both tall, thin, strict, patriarchal, religious. one was Muslim and didn't drink, one was Christian and didn't drink. But, you know... They were exactly the same people, and outsider would see them as completely different because one wore sort of long robes and a skull cap and lived in the middle of the African plains, and one lived in a small house in the north of Scotland. But they were very, very similar personalities, and they ran their households in the same way, only that my Scottish grandfather only had one wife to order around, and my... Sierra Leonean grandfather had 16, but...
Small difference.
Beyond that, they were very similar. So it is, you know, it is that about learning to see that people are more alike than unalike and simply looking for what it is that has caused those differences of thinking or being. Mm.
So we're here talking to an audience that is partly from the International Museum of Women. And one of the things that I wanted to ask you about was telling women's stories. Your first novel, Ancestor Stones, is told through the experiences of four different women. And we've spoken a little bit about the fact that you had this very intense feeling that women's stories were not being captured and were not being relayed and portrayed. And talk to us a bit about that as a motivating force in your work.
I was researching The Devil That Danced on the Water, and it was the war, sort of the tail end of the war in Sierra Leone. I'd gone there and things were still very disrupted. A lot of my family were refugees, but I'd sort of got to the point where I simply had to get on with this story. And actually, the country was also beginning to want answers. So I was driven to go back at that time, and I was talking to a lot of members of my family, them partly for the story, but also finding out a little bit about our own antecedents. And they had also, you should speak to Auntie Adama, she knows the story. So I tracked her down, and she was living in this little house in Freetown. I had my cousin Molly with me, and she didn't speak English, and at that time I didn't speak Timni. I've been subsequently learning it, but he came to act as interpreter. And so we told her what we wanted, and she said that she would tell us what she knew. And she began this story about my great-grandfather and my great-grandmother. And she simply began with the words, "At the time of the Banka Wars, Palmolive was a warrior." And the story just unfolded. And it was absolutely extraordinary. And the story, which I won't tell you now because it's a bit long, but it's a rather wonderful story about he was a warlord, and he invaded the area where my great-grandmother was the daughter of a king. And she was married to him either, we think, as a part of a peace negotiation, or she was captured in battle. We're not quite sure which, but she was certainly enslaved and married to him. And she won her freedom from him in quite a remarkable way, quite a clever and remarkable way. And he had clearly fallen in love with her and followed her and tried to win her back. And it was a rather marvellous story. And we were listening to this account. But I was aware that it was incredibly hot, that we were packed into this little courtyard. There weren't seats. My cousin was squatting on the floor. And so at one point I said to him, Monai, should we come back tomorrow? Do you want to take a break and we'll come back and finish this tomorrow? And he looked at me and he went, no, I've never heard these stories. So we went, and now I wrote all of that in The Devil That Danced on the Water. It was the story of our family. But I, literally that voice stayed with me of this woman telling stories. And I thought, these are all going to be gone. These voices, that world that she's talking about, where women got married and carried on litters to meet husbands, it's just all going to go. So, I decided that I wanted to write a novel with the voices of those women at the centre. And I remember quite close to that time, I interviewed a writer called Zizi Dangaremba, who is a Zimbabwean writer. She's one of the first women. She is the first black African Zimbabwean woman to be published. And she was quoted as saying, she had been quoted as saying, and I came across the quotation, that she started to write because she had never seen herself in literature, and she wanted to see herself there. Mm. And I had never seen these women in literature. So I spent a long time researching the book. I was out there the best part of 6 months to a year in Sierra Leone, just talking to women from probably the youngest in their mid-60s right up to women who were in their mid-90s about what their lives had been like, about who they had loved and who they had lost and how they had felt at key points in Sierra Leone's history and their own stories. And what was quite fascinating about it is that I would begin every interview with this great big preamble, and I'd say, this is for research, I'm writing a novel, I'm not going to use your real story, I just want to know, how lives were. They didn't care. I mean, they absolutely didn't care what I was going to do with the stories. What they wanted to do was tell their stories, and they had a listener for the first time. So, it is a work of fiction, but those voices are there very much of that world that, is rapidly, rapidly disappearing.
And as you look across the contemporary kind of literary landscape, but also more broadly the kind of media landscape that we all inhabit, is your sense that we are hearing more sort of untold stories from women and the kind of multiple identities of and experiences of women are being represented? Or, I mean, I think it can sometimes feel with the kind of predominance of chick lit and the kind of, you know, the sort of Real Housewives kind of franchises, that the stories we're being told about women are kind of narrowing rather than expanding. And I just wonder, as a media professional, as a novelist, what you think about that?
I mean, certainly as a novelist, I would say expanding dramatically. I mean, with the media on the whole, yes, perhaps that has all kind of taken a middle line. But certainly with novelists, I mean, I don't think I would have been published 30 years ago. I think they would doubt that the idea that Middle England isn't just in Africa would also have pervaded publishing. And I think publishing houses have been much, much braver in this territory about commissioning writers with a different kind of experience. And I think also there's a hunger. You know, as we've moved into a much more global community, people want to hear those stories. People want to hear each other's stories and make sense of them. People might go and work in Japan for a bit. They might want to go and work in Korea, South Africa. You know, and there's a saying, if you want to know a country, read its writers. I think people want to have that experience. And I think there's a freshness about these voices. There's a writer called Carmela Shamsi. She's a British Pakistani writer. And, you know, she said, I was listening to her speak, and she said, well, every time I want a new book, I just go back to Pakistan and lasso another story. You know, and one seam has been mined greatly, and another seam, you know, has been left fallow for so long. These stories are all there waiting to be told. But the interesting counterpoint to that, actually, is that what you see certainly in Britain, I don't know about the States, perhaps somebody in the audience will tell me, or you can, but so we've seen a sort of a trend in both directions, backwards and forwards, which is that the novels set in stately homes are doing awfully well at the same time. So, you know, but I think this is a great time to be a female novelist, really.
Well, that brings us wonderfully to your current novel, The Memory of Love, which is just an incredibly gripping read. For those of you who live in San Francisco, my story is that I was reading this novel on Muni going underground, and I was so gripped that I missed my stop by several stops. I was actually very late to pick up my daughter from her childcare because I was on the other side of town when I should have been back picking up my daughter. So it's really a riveting, incredible read. And it spans themes from memory and love to obsession and war and mental illness, themes of complicity and resistance. Really just an incredibly striking book, and I enjoyed it immensely. Tell us some more about how the theme for this novel found you.
There were two places it came from. Let me think. There were two places. The themes actually are sort of part of the work of my life about responsibility and the way in which we choose to take or not to take responsibility in the societies we inhabit. So that's something that's always been very important to me, and I don't think that was going to let me go for a while. It was a lot of it was in The Devil, the Dance, and the Water. That was partly a theme in Ancestor Stones about the way that different women react to their situation. With The Memory of Love, it arose actually before I had written either of my two books. And of course, I didn't know it was going to be a book then. It was just an idea, a little something. But I was having lunch with a friend of mine from Argentina. You know, there was a whole time this book was going to be set in Argentina if I ever wrote it. I was going to speak brilliant Spanish somehow and go to Argentina and write this book because where the lead character, Elias Cole, came from was a conversation that I had with an Argentinian friend of mine in London. And I was going, at that time, I was about to go back to Sierra Leone to research The Devil That Danced on the Water, the circumstances of my father's political murder. And she told me that she had grown up in Argentina during the Dirty War, and that a lot of her father's colleagues, he was an academic at a university, her father's colleagues had disappeared. Friends and neighbours had disappeared or been imprisoned or fled. A boy she had a crush on at school disappeared along with his entire family. Her father survived it all, In fact, he didn't just survive, his career flourished. And she said that as she grew older, she had to ask herself a question about her father and about his moral stance and what was happening. Because she said, how could he have done so well? You know, when anyone who stood up to what was going on paid the price, how could he have flourished? And she said, there came a time when I just had to ask myself, how can it be? So this was where the seed of the idea for Elias Cole came, the man who is somewhere along the lines of the good man that does nothing, but is doing nothing ever. And it's that line between silence, complicity, you know, at what point do you actually become complicit with something? So I was quite fascinated in that, and of course I did think, oh, off I'll go to Argentina. But then, of course, I went to Sierra Leone, began to investigate my own story, my family's story, met Elias Cole after Elias Cole. All these people who, and in the wake of the war, were now busy rewriting the past, justifying their positions. So that's really where Elias Cole himself came from. The three main characters, actually. There's Elias Cole, there's a young British psychologist called Adrian. Elias Cole is telling his story to, and Adrian is the listener. And he, at some point, has to make a judgment about whether what Elias Cole is saying is can be believed. Adrian actually appears in Ancestor Stones, mm-hmm. and he's in the last story in Ancestor Stones. And he listens to a lady called Mariama talk about her wartime experiences. And I took him out of Ancestor Stones and gave him a new life in the memory of love, partly because I'd been kind of mean to him in Ancestor Stones. You know, I mean, in Ancestor Stones, he just doesn't get it. You know, he really doesn't get it. And I sort of thought, well, you know, why not? And maybe he will. And so
you took him on that journey, yeah.
Yeah. And then the last character, Kai, is a young Sierra Leonean surgeon. And he came to me. Well, he's a friend of Adrian's. He's somebody that Adrian gets to know when he works there. And in fact, these three men find that their lives are intertwined in a way that I won't reveal. But Kai came to me because this is an embarrassing story. I challenged somebody to a race on a beach in Sierra Leone, and I broke my Achilles tendon. This was really dumb, and I have to say that I won the race.
Who won? Yeah.
I won the race, okay, but he had to carry me to hospital, so it didn't look good. But I was definitely in the lead. Anyway, this was really a dumb thing to do because there wasn't really a functioning hospital in Sierra Leone at that time. I mean, I didn't have any idea you could do this kind of injury running down a beach. I mean, I just turned 40. This is classically when you do that, isn't it? But I went to the hospital for amputees and war victims in a bikini. That was embarrassing. But the good thing was, of course, it was full of orthopedic surgeons. And they attended to me very kindly. And actually, even when I was there, and even when I was on the trolley, and even while I was having my foot examined and learning that I was going to have to fly out of the country to go. Well, actually, they did offer to do the operation there, and I was all for it. But they did say, go home. But I became completely fascinated by this hospital, which was a pool of serenity in the middle of a completely chaotic country. Here were people where everybody knew their function, everybody knew their job, and things worked and things happened. And the character, I mean, what I asked the hospital, once I was mended, I went to Britain, had my operation, went back to Sierra Leone, I gave them a wheelchair and things, and then I asked if I could just spend some time in the hospital following different people. I mean, this is where I get my ideas from, really, is from research and following. And I followed two surgeons and an ICU nurse. And I did, you know, one of the surgeons who was Sierra Leonean, just thought, this is extraordinary. Here's a world he can control. He can control absolutely nothing else. None of us can. But here's a world he can control. And here's a world where he can fix people. And especially in the field of orthopedics, you know, you can mend people's limbs and you can get them walking again. So I, you know, that character came out of that, and also the fact that there I was in Sierra Leone being attended by NGO volunteer medics, and when I flew to Britain and I went to have my operation at King's Hospital, what do I find? All my nurses are from Sierra Leone. You know, and this one Sierra Leonean surgeon told me, I asked him about this, and he said that he was the only member of his graduating class still working in Sierra Leone. Everybody else had been poached or lured to work for the National Health Service in Britain or for an American hospital. And this was his conflict. This was a conflict for the whole generation, actually, and that's the conflict that, if Elias's conflict is whether to act or not, the new generation's conflict is whether to stay or go. And actually, more and more people in developing countries, the whole idea is you get out if you possibly can. You know, only the stupid people stay. If you have a choice, you go. So yeah, that was really where that character came from. And so these are the three voices that you hear in.
And it's interesting you talking about generations, because I think what's very striking in the kind of retrospective pieces of the novel is the sense of optimism that was around in the time of Elias and others. And I just wonder, you know, is the optimism for the new generation really all about departing or leaving? Or is do you see the potential for a source of optimism that is about remaining and giving resilience and optimism to their country?
You know, my favourite cousin, Molly, his son, unbeknownst to him, had entered the green card lottery in the United States Embassy. And he won. He got an offer of a green card, which he had to take up within a year. And my cousin was devastated because he doesn't believe that leaving is the best thing. And he knows actually what happens to a lot of people who it's not that easy to make it in the West. And I have to say that, I mean, he asked me to talk to his son. I told him what it would require for him to make it in America. And after much thought, the young man decided to turn down the green card and stay in Sierra Leone. And I thought that was an act of extraordinary optimism and courage and bravery. And, you know, he did it. He was 19, 20 years old, and he took that decision that he's going to sort of stick with his country. I think that people have begun to understand that leaving actually doesn't produce, you know, the answers that that they had imagined. That life is very hard if you try and make your way as an immigrant somewhere else without anything to support you. So they do understand that, and I know wonderful, wonderful people working in Sierra Leone, doing amazing things. One of my cousins is one of two government paediatricians in Sierra Leone. The infant mortality rate has just plummeted recently. Mm. So, I mean, now the figures are official, but at the time, WHO wouldn't accept the figures. They wanted to rerun them because they were so astonished by the rate of the decrease. So I was talking to him. I said, well, you must feel pleased. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, you're one of two government paediatricians. I said, it's you. I mean, you know, that's a sort of identifiable success. And he went, yeah, you're right, I do feel pleased. So there are wonderful people out there doing really wonderful things. What is really missing is the sense that we can do it ourselves. You know, and Sierra Leone, well, actually, virtually every African country I can think of really just sort of needs a much stronger sense of self, a much stronger sense of self-belief. We're very, very critical of ourselves, you know, of course, that's important too, but it's kind of flipped too far the other way, and actually we do need some self-belief, and we do need to feel that all the ideas are not coming from outside, that actually that understanding, expertise and wisdom exists within the country, and we don't have to bring it in.
I wanted to ask you about another really sort of pivotal theme that emerges in the novel, which is around maternal health and mortality. And I know that it's the topic of maternal health and indeed mothering is something that's interested you for a while in different guises. I just wondered if you could speak a bit more to why you wanted to foreground that issue.
Well, it's not even so much that I want to. It's that, you know, because a lot of my ideas are formed by my research. So I sometimes get the germ of an idea, and then what I really do with both ancestor stones and the memory of love is I go into that world and I see how people's lives are and what's affecting them, and that then informs the book. That's really where the ideas come from, because otherwise it would be quite artificial, one might. So I was actually at the hospital, and a woman arrived, and she came in a tremendous rush on a trolley, and she had a half-delivered baby between her legs, and the baby was quite obviously dead. And they managed to, she had to have a sort of emergency delivery, and I asked the nurse what had happened, and he said, well, she had come on the bus. And, you know, there's always a sort of sense of anger and outrage in the hospital. Women don't get there earlier. Mm. But then, you know, I had a conversation some years before with a chief medical officer who had told me that he'd actually set up a program that had worked very well before the war in the south of the country, where he got people to put in small amounts of money each into a little pot, like a little sort of insurance pot that you could draw on if you needed it. Because he said, actually, what happened wasn't that these people didn't love their daughters or love their wives or want to save them or take them to hospital or lack the knowledge that they needed to go to hospital. It's that nobody ever had any ready cash. So when the woman got into difficulty, they were actually running around trying to get the money. By the time they took her to the hospital, of course, it was all too late. So he set up this little system, which actually had been used by farmers, collectives of farmers. You put in a little bit of money, if your barn burned down, you could withdraw from it. And that's what he did for women's maternal health, and succeeded in reducing the rate of the incidence of maternal mortality greatly. So, you know, I sort of felt like there was a misunderstanding, a kind of cultural misunderstanding going on. But also, and that's something that I'm always very interested in exploring, but also that actually, you know, if you have to sort of, as a writer, you have to look realistically at what might happen to your character. And when 1 in 8 women in Sierra Leone die in childbirth, that is a very realistic possibility. You don't, you know, you don't have to think up a dramatic ending for a character, if just getting pregnant can end your life. So, you know, I put things in a very real setting, and that's a very real thing that could happen to a character. And it's also, you know, a world without... we spoke about this before, it's a world... I think in the West we find it very difficult to understand a world without mothers. I mean, of course, there are many women who will act as your mother, and that is a great benefit in that society. Aunties step in, co-wives step in. You know, you're always mothered by somebody. But the chances that you will grow up without your biological mother are very, very high. And even in my family, my father's mother died in childbirth and my stepmother's mother died in childbirth. So both grandmothers on my Sierra Leonean side died in childbirth. When I was there, 2009, one of my cousins died in childbirth. They knew, you know, they got her to the hospital on time, they had money. She was the absolute light of her mother's. I mean, her mother died very soon afterwards. She simply died of a broken heart. This was a girl that they'd put through college. She was working at the British Council. She was taking care of her mother, who was infirm, and she died having her first baby. So, you know, so much hope goes when these things happen. And when, you know, for example, it's, you know, what I said earlier, it's about just shifting and looking at things from a different perspective and thinking about why people think the way they do. I was asked once, why don't people in Sierra Leone educate their daughters? And the answer is, they can't afford to. If you can only educate one child, you have to choose the one that's not going to die in childbirth. So, you know, they're making these very practical decisions about it, and it's not for a lack of love. It is because they've got to place the family hopes on somebody who can survive it. Survive these things. So, you know, it becomes a part of a small theme in the book. There are a couple of instances. I don't want to give away the story, but it's certainly something that comes up in the book. And, it is about giving your characters very real lives about the things that might happen.
I want to remind the audience that we're taking questions for Aminata. You have blue cards on your chair, so please pass those to the volunteers who are moving around the room, because we'll transition into audience questions in a moment. But first, I wanted to ask you about the different social change projects, if you like, that have been birthed by your different books. And I know that you have projects in Sierra Leone that you've implemented that have sprung from each of those different works. So maybe you could tell the audience a bit about the genesis of those projects and what you were doing in your village.
It all kind of happened by chance, really, I have to say. I didn't sort of set out to do it. But and actually, it was somebody else who pointed out to me. Somebody said, every time you write a book, a project comes out of it. So I thought, I'm either going to have to stop writing books or, or
maybe
just
write
sort of
more.
Get on with the projects away. You know. But the school that you talked about, Rabonko Village School, that very much came out of The Devil That Danced on the Water. My father was the only person in the family to receive a Western education, and it transformed his life and consequently transformed my life. My cousins live in very different circumstances to me. My father went to school actually because his mother had died, and when a missionary school opened some miles away and asked each family to send a child, none of the wives wanted to let their children go. They wanted their children to stay close. Nobody knew anything about these things called schools run by foreigners. So they decided to keep their children, and they said, oh, we'll send him, because he didn't have a mum. So off he went, and the rest is history. He became a doctor, left the country. And always had a very, very strong sense of the importance of education. And so I knew that that was the legacy that he had left. I mean, I really didn't do that well at school until the end of my school career. But my father was always on my back, telling me how well how much harder I had to work, and hiring me math tutors in the holidays and things, which I greatly resented at the time, of course, which made a huge difference. So I knew it was important to him. And by the time I went back to my family village after the war, they had all, of course, come to understand the importance of education. Everyone, 50 years or 60 years later, everyone understood why you needed a Western education. So I was asked to help, and actually we decided quite simply that the amount of money it cost to send one child from the village to go to school somewhere else would actually cover the cost of a teacher going to the village. So we decided to pay for a teacher. It would be too much to tell you the whole story, but it started with one teacher and a little school made of thatch and bamboo that was put up in 3 days. That was our first schoolhouse, and the only literate person in the village became the school teacher. And now we have 5 classrooms, we have a library, we have a staff room, a games pitch, we have solar lighting, we have all kinds of things, and 5 teachers. So that's really done wonders, and it's completely, completely run by the village themselves. I don't have to do anything. I mean, I help them with the fundraising, but they run the entire project themselves, whether they hire and fire teachers, kids, curriculum, everything is their responsibility. And then since then, we've also done various things, malaria control by giving out mosquito nets. Very simple. We just give each kid every couple of years a mosquito net that they and all their siblings can sleep under. We've refitted one of the wells in the village and dug another well at the opposite end, because one well kept drying up, and we had 2 serious illness outbreaks, one cholera, one an amoebic dysentery outbreak from people using the river water. So we did some work on sanitation and also put in what they call VIP latrines, ventilated improved pit latrines, which are much more hygienic. And also an agricultural project, growing cashews, where I started a project on a piece of land given to me by the village, called it actually Khalifa Estates after the one in the novel. But they very much wanted a cash crop project. They're all subsistence farmers growing rice, and they needed a cash crop project, but they needed to be able to do it under the the auspices of a larger project, because on their own they can't sell the produce from a dozen or so cashew trees, but together we can. So I run Khalifa Estates, and we've now been joined by 9 farmers who are growing cashews on their land and who will be able to use the benefits of selling their cashews along with us to the processing plant. And now, the last thing is the maternal health centre, which is I got a call last week saying they'd cleared the ground, they've chosen the ground, someone's donated a piece of land, they've chosen the land that's going to be on. I sent a friend of mine up there who was a midwife at Chelsea and Westminster, which is one of our premier hospitals in London, and she was a midwife there for years. She's Sierra Leonean. She runs her own maternal health projects all over the country. She came and spoke to the women in my village, the traditional birth attendants, and gave them a day-long seminar, just in really the basics, so that they can recognise when to send a woman to hospital. They can, know in advance when they have to get ready for those sorts of scenarios. And so she's asked them to set up this little unit, and the young men of the village have taken that on themselves to do for their sisters, mothers, wives. And so they're building it, and it'll be just a little two-room facility, but just a hygienic place for the women to go and give birth, with a proper attendant who'll be there, and some basic equipment like blood pressure.
Fantastic, thank you. So now I'm going to transition into questions from the audience. And the first question is around the influence of women in Africa and in Sierra Leone, and what role women, in your experience, are playing in peace reconciliation projects?
Interesting. I mean, Sierra Leone is the land of strong women to me. It's been described as a matriarchy posing as a patriarchy.
That's a great decision.
Which isn't to say that there isn't a patriarchy, and of course, women are very vocal in Sierra Leone and have been extremely vocal in civil society. Very early on, something that wasn't reported about the women's movements, very early on in the war, when a lot of young men were joining either the rebel army or there were a lot of soldiers who sort of were switching sides and forming their own groups and looting and raiding villages. It was the women's movement who set out the call to other women to ask, when your son comes home with a dress or a piece of jewellery or a pair of shoes, ask him where it came from and don't accept it. And so they started this. And in lots of villages and towns, women who had been given these gifts by looting sons took them into the square and burned them and said, we don't want this, we won't have this. That was even before, that was way before we had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Even before that, in 1996, it was the women who brought in the last democratic election before the war. My mother, my stepmom, was one of them, and she woke up on the morning, she was a returning electoral officer, a lot of them were women, and she woke up there in the morning, there was gunfire, the army was out on the streets, they didn't want people to vote. And my stepfather said to her, he told me, I told her not to go. The car didn't come to pick her up because the drivers were all too scared. She set out, she walked down the road, she met other women all walking out together. And, it was a brilliant idea because actually the only person in that country who could face off a young soldier with a gun was his mother, frankly. And actually, the men stayed behind, and the women went out, and they brought in the vote, and they defied the army to do it. So actually, women have had this sort of wonderful and often unsung role to play, in trying to prevent the conflict and then in dealing with the conflict when it came about, and certainly in terms of reconciliation, very much so. It's very, very involved in civil society.
And a related question, which is, have the women and the men in Sierra Leone, those you interviewed and those more broadly, read your work?
Well, to Well, let me put that question into a framework, which is that we still have only 10% functional literacy in Sierra Leone. So, I mean, people can read street signs and things like that, but to actually be able to read a complex work of literature, not that many people can do it. So I have to put it in that context. Of that, what I do know is that young people at the universities are absolutely engaged in the work that I do and in reading alternative accounts of their own country. Particularly, it started with The Devil That Danced on the Water, of course, which was the first time anybody had broken the silence of the last 25 years. And when I give talks in the country, you know, everybody, all these young people come to them and, you know, tell me we were never told any of this. You know, they had grown up with an official history. They said over and over again that they'd gone to their parents and said, did these things happen? And their parents said, yes. They said, why didn't you tell us? Very often the parents said, well, we were too scared. So, I mean, I can give you an example. We didn't have a single bookshop, you know. You just can't imagine. It's a completely different world. We don't have a single bookshop. Even if we did, you know, the amount that publishers would sell any of my books for would be unaffordable, and I'm afraid I don't have the right to breach that agreement. So, but I certainly have given many copies of my books, 50 to the University of Fura Bay and 50 to the British Council Library. This was with The Devil That Danced on the Water, and I've given Ancestor Stained as well, but with The Devil That Danced on the Water, I was given a figure by the British Council librarian who said they had 50 copies, and each copy had a wait list of 50 on it.
Oh, my goodness.
So that was how much people wanted to read. And then another interesting thing that happened, well, The Devil That Danced on the Water actually was abridged and went out on the World Service, so a lot of people heard it on the radio. But secondly, there's a wonderful way in which oral culture becomes written culture becomes oral culture. Mm. Because, for example, my cousin, and I know other people do this too, give readings from the book, and people come. So from The Devil That Danced on the Water and Ancestor Stones, he read a chapter every day, and people would come at 7 o'clock in the evening after they'd had their supper and listen to the next instalment of the book. And that happens, you know, I've heard of that happening quite a bit. So. Yeah, they are. They are.
So, is there an extent to which your memoir has catalysed other people's expressions or writing or speaking the truth about what happened to them? Did it open up the possibility for a different kind of conversation?
Well, it's interesting. Actually, let me just say about us not having a bookshop. We actually do now have a bookshop, which has been set up by a very enterprising Sierra Leone who's gone back. It's called Diaspora. But in terms of, you know, a commercial bookshop, not yet. But. Yes, I started teaching creative writing in Sierra Leone when I went back through the British Council. I started holding writing workshops. And what was very interesting is, you know, I assumed that people would want to write about the war. When they came to my sessions, I assumed they'd want to write about the war. Actually, and rather delightfully, they didn't. They wanted to write about love. And most of them produced love stories and stories about families and stories about, you know, they actually at that point had lived through the war, and I don't think they could quite go back to it so soon. Now, yes, people are writing, you know, and that writing group, I mean, they don't need me now, they've gone on, you know, there's a wonderful circle of writers in Sierra Leone, and some of them have done very well. I sit on the board of the Cane Prize as well, and so I every now and again see a writer that I encountered out there coming up in front of the judges. Yes, you know, people, there's a wonderful self-expression in writing. We just need a publishing house.
Maybe that's the next project. What about human nature fascinates you the most? Questioner wants to know.
Ooh, all of it. All of it. Probably the mutability, I think. The mutability. I have a great love of dogs. So, I mean, who would in this room just... Who doesn't? I mean, I don't know. If you don't like dogs, I don't want to. I love dogs. And even though one hospitalised me once. But the thing I love about dogs is the clarity of their position. And I do credit them with saving my life. I wrote a piece for Granta about dogs recently. And it was, you know, when we were going through all of the things that were happening in my childhood, and I couldn't trust anybody. I didn't know who to trust. Our family couldn't trust anybody. And we found out later, people we had had in our house, our driver was spying on us. You know, so we just lived in this world of complete distrust. And I do remember very clearly, and my sister once said to me, how did you cope? Because, you know, and I said, well, it was the dogs. You know, ultimately, there was this one creature that you could sort of trust to be loyal and trust to tell you what it felt. So, I'm being slightly flippant, but it is the mutability of human nature that fascinates me, that you just don't ever quite know with a human what you've got.
And the same questioner asks, having heard so many women's stories, what is it that you find as the kind of common unifying theme or themes in those stories?
Well, I've just written a book entirely in the voices of men. You know, The Memory of Love is all in male voices, and The Of Ancestors Turned is all in female voices. And it is quite liberating to write as a man, I have to say. I personally have an awful lot more fun. I was always a tomboy, you know, so writing as a man is an expression of my inner male, and I really enjoyed it. The women have to work quite hard to maximise their choices. That's what I feel, is that they're always working within constraints, and they're always working to maximise their choices within those constraints. Certainly for the women in Ancestor Stones, but I think it would be true of actually even the most, you know, powerful career women in this country, always working within constraints and having to try to find ways of giving yourself more possibilities or choices or perhaps making sacrifices. But that did seem to be a very common female.
So I have time for one last question, which is about what the future holds. Are there more novels in the works? Are there more social change projects for your village in the works? What is your next aspiration?
Oh, God. So we get the maternal health centre built and the cashew crop brought in, and I'm working on a new novel. But I'm a little, I have to say, I'm a little superstitious about describing what I'm working on, just in case it all falls apart and everyone keeps saying, so how's that novel going? But I am working on another novel, and but now at the moment just you know, enjoying launching this one and being on tour in the States and talking to people like you. So,
well, wonderful, thank you. This has been such a privilege.
Thank you.
I want to again thank Aminata for such an incredible and stimulating insight into her work and her thinking and her incredible new novel. And I'm thrilled to say that we have the opportunity to buy the novel here tonight, thanks to our partnership with Book Passage. So please, if you would like to buy a book, the table is there. Aminata has very generously volunteered to sign and inscribe those copies for you. I also wanted to let you know, for those of you who are interested, that Aminata will be interviewed tomorrow morning at 10 a.m., I believe, on KQED with Michael Krasny. So watch out for that. And
something different to say.
And we have an information table just in the foyer for both the International Museum of Women and the World Affairs Council. Both organisations have some great programmes and events coming up that we would love to share with you. And if you would like to join mailing lists or become a member, that information is out there for you as well. But thank you so much for joining us this evening and for all your support.